can begin in good conscience. Dr. Harry Huth was unable to be with us today to conduct a discussion on gospel and scripture which had been planned. Dr. Weber had at one point been scheduled for a convocation here and had been compelled by the press of duty to cancel that appointment. It's the stroke of the greatest good fortune under God's blessing for him to have been available on short notice for today. Since we've already lost some time out of our hour that extends to 11:45, we should turn the floor over to you immediately, Dr. Weber, for the subject of a board of control of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
Thank you, Professor Hoffman. I have before me this book that's been maligned so much over the last year or two, and still it contains the regulations by which the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod functions, and there has to be, of course, order. I don't consider this a legalistic document at all, because it begins back there in 1847 with a constitution, and then bylaws were added from time to time as opportunity presented itself and also necessity. You people know that where more than two people live together, there have to be regulations of some kind. And the regulations that are in this book were lovingly arrived at by thinking people. And the thing has served us well over the 127, 28 years of our existence as the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Among other things, it also contains its paragraphs on what an institution of synod is expected to do, how it should function, and how it should be done in an orderly manner through a board of control for each of the 16 institutions that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod operates and has operated over the years. So at St. Louis Seminary, Concordia here, there is also a board of control, as there is one for every institution. This consists of people who have been elected at a convention of synod, nine of them, and then the two appointees who come ex officio, the president of the Missouri district, and then the representative of the president of the synod, and I am here as his representative, have been for the last 5 years. I lived through all the problems and troubles that Concordia Seminary has had. There are two things that I want to say by way of introduction. One, if an institution is well organized and well run, it's a joy and a pleasure to be a member of the Board of Control. The hard times come when troubles come, and they surely came to Concordia Seminary over the years. I had much fun and pleasure in being a member of the Board of Control of Ann Arbor, the Concordia Junior College there, because that functioned well and seemed to have peace and harmony and unity, and so we went about our business pleasurably. It was always something to look forward to, and the same thing cannot always be said of our meetings here over these years. Your Board of Control here has 11 members. Nine of them are elected by the synod. They have to be members of congregations. They consist of pastors, and in the new rubric, and for the first time at the next convention of synod, there will be two teachers, three pastors, and four lay people. They are to be representative of the synod. And as you look at your Board of Control now, you have one layman from Chicago, one from Cleveland, several from here, a pastor from Florida, And the rest, I guess, are all from here. The pastors are there, I suppose, for the theological end of it, and also as those who represent parishes, and so have their origin and their feet planted firmly in the parish, and would therefore know what it is about to train someone for the parish ministry of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Teachers, because a pastor also doubles in that, not necessarily as a man in the classroom, although that is done still here and there, but particularly also in instructions in confirmation classes and with Bible class and Sunday school teachers' meetings and topic studies for various societies and so forth and so on. In fact, I often wonder whether the pastor doesn't spend as much time teaching as he does sermon preparation and sermon delivery. Now, all of these things you have on your board of control, Pastor E.J. Otto as the chairman from Quincy, Illinois. You have Walter Disson, an attorney for a railroad in Cleveland. You have Mr. Roschke, who is in the voice production of Zenith Radio and Television, an engineer. You have Mr. Breel, who is a certified public accountant and has, I think, five offices in southern Indiana and northern Kentucky. Then you have Mr. Burmeister, a former treasurer of the International LLL, as well as a financial consultant over a period of many years. You have Mr. Gene Finke, who is the senior vice president and senior loan officer of the Mercantile Bank downtown, and he didn't fall on his head when he was little, otherwise you don't get to that kind of a position in a $3 billion affair. $3 billion. If you can imagine what that is, you're better off than I am. I know something about nickels and dimes and a dollar here and there. But when you start talking about billions, and I had a little experience with some millions years ago as a chairman of the Church Extension Board of the Michigan District, where we had 15 million to worry about. And what is that when you talk about $3 billion? But he's there, and valuable counsel, of course. Then the pastors are Bugey and Breel. Bugey from St. Louis here, and Beal from Florida. That's about the extent of, and a teacher, Nickel, Paul Nickel from Webster Gardens. From now on, there will be two teachers, one less layman, and the pastors will be the same. The president of Missouri and the synodical president's representative will still be there. This is it. Now, what do? They are charged by the church in this little old handbook. Now, it cuts two directions. It tells boards and commissions and what have you what to do, and it tells the people to whom they address themselves, how they may influence this board of control. The board of control of each of the institutions is charged with certain duties. The business end of it is usually taken care of by a business manager, and you have one here, Mr. Lindgren, of course, with whom I'm sure you're all acquainted with the business office. What's the thing to do? Each board is the governing body of the institution. And that isn't only a privilege, it's also an obligation. And the board of control is responsible to the church. First, to the board of directors for the physical things, buildings and grounds and additions and what have you to the buildings and insurance and all this kind of stuff. And then through the BHE, for the academic end of it, the care of the professors and whatever else there is to it, the curriculum has to be gone through with them, and we then render a report to the Synodical Convention. Also, this board is to take care of all grants and bequests and such things. The budget at this seminary in 1972-3 school year was a little over $3 million. The Synod contributed $1,050,000 of this in order to undergird the finances of the institution. You fellows, of course, pay your share by way of fees of various kinds, yet you'd have to pay a whole lot more if it weren't for the subsidy which Synod provides. And now they give all this over to the Board of Control and say, you manage it. So the Board of Control has a treasurer, Mr. Burmeister, who regularly consults with the business manager to keep all things straight. I don't know what kind of respect you people have for the wisdom and sagacity in financial matters of preachers. How do you manage your own affairs? And pretty soon you'll be looking at congregational budgets and things of that nature. And it is usually noised around among the laymen that when it comes to finances, the preacher is pretty stupid, especially when he keeps talking about how they ought to contribute more money so that more things can get done already on the congregational level. And it's no different, I suppose, in matters such as this. That is why a wise and prudent preacher will keep his mouth shut when the laymen discuss the finances of the institution, about which they know a whole lot more than I know, and I can freely admit that. But it's there. The whole works is there, the business end of it, and then also, of course, the financial obligations, contractual arrangements, and all this stuff goes through that Board of Control. Then the general functions of a Board of Control, aside from these business things, they are responsible for the educational program at the institution. Now then, the professors are professors, and then the preachers are preachers and laymen are laymen. And we have to understand that there is a kind of tension always existing in all of this. Certainly no member of the Board of Control wants to interfere with the efficient method of instruction and how it goes. So we have a Dr. Klotz around, the academic dean. And we have a president where everything lands finally, Dr. Bowman. Then you have heads of departments, and through all of this, the curriculum is developed, it is passed on by the Board for Higher Education, and so the academics function. And when that all functions smoothly and well, then the Board of Control is extremely happy. There comes, however, a time when all this doesn't go as well as it ought. There are differences of opinion, and particularly in our case, there were differences of doctrine. The authority of the Board of Control extends beyond the limits of the campus. When professors go out to speak, their off-campus activities also come under the scrutiny of the Board of Control. This does not always make for happy landings either. Then the general welfare of the students of the institution, part of it, and the collection and disbursements of books and all assets of the institution are part of the duties of the Board of Control. Members of the faculty are appointed. I don't know whether you people know about all this, and maybe somebody from here should tell you about that end of it. I'm not in it, but I am an interested sidewalk superintendent. And here, all of a sudden, pop up some names, and the president of the institution then recommends somebody, and the Board of Control then interviews and finds out about this man, biographical material, his abilities as far as teaching is concerned, his interests and his specialties, his expertise in whatever department of learning he is to serve. And then come the electors, finally, if all this is positive and agreeable. And the electors goes like this. There are four of these who have a vote. The Board of Control as a body has one vote. The Board for Higher Education as a body has one vote. The President of Synod has one vote. And the president of the district in which the institution is located, in our case, Missouri, has a vote. So these cast their votes, and three of them elect a professor to his position. All this business with tenure and all of that, I think your people here can probably explain to you better than I can. The Board of Control... We had, of course, some problems with all this. You recall the business when Professor Getting was not reappointed. And then we retired a few people. And all of this is always questioned by everybody. But the rules and regulations are pretty plain. And I submit to you that I'm sure these the faculty, which is here, most of it for this year the first time, although some have taught in other circumstances under other management and so forth. But I would imagine that every professor, before he accepts a position to teach, has looked in here to see what goes on. Now then, there are regulations about a contract, about tenure, and about retirement, and about refusal to renew, and this without telling too many reasons, without cause is the word that's used here. Now, we did some of that, and were, of course, roundly criticized, and but that didn't deter anybody from what they were doing. Without cause, is that fair that you dismiss a man or fail to renew his contract without telling him the ins and outs? Number one, a Board of Control consists of these 11 people. Now, is there always corporate agreement on everything that goes on in this Board of Control? I may want to retire someone for one reason, somebody else for another, and there can be 11 reasons then, each one of the members of the board with his own. However, once the idea is there that a man should retire, now what reason do you give him? I recall as president of a district, some congregation had wanted a candidate from out east. And I dutifully followed this up, and the man, the president under whom he was serving, I wrote to him and told him to give me the inside dope on this fellow. And he called me. He said, I don't want to put it on paper, but the man at the moment is in a state hospital. Nervous breakdown or mixed up or whatever it was. And now I tell the congregation that wanted to have him as one of their candidates, this man just is not available. And the fellow who had been kind of shepherding his name through You've got to tell us the reason. And I say, well, you're up a stump because I'm not going to. However, trust me, I don't want to tell the world that this man is crazy. What would that do to his reputation for the rest of his life? And so there have been other instances. I think the kindest thing we can do is not to tell why, but to put enough faith and trust and confidence in these men that they know what they are doing and are doing it for the benefit of the kingdom of God and out of kindness and Christian concern and love for their fellow man. So when you now retire a professor, you hear him say that he is a better teacher now than he's ever been in his life. Everybody says that. Preachers who are forcibly retired from their office usually say the same thing. However, I'm not the best judge in the world of what my capacities are, and I'm 64 years old, and I know that I've been sharper in my life than I am today. I also know that I could stand a whole lot more guff than I can today. I also know that I could stay with things a whole lot longer physically than I can today. And there's no use kidding anybody. If under my reduced powers I can still function, okay, fine. But I'm not going to stand around and tell the world that I'm better now than I was when I was 25. Biggest lie in the world. I can't even fish like I used to be able to back then. To say nothing of trying to do the work that is necessary in order that the program might go forward. Well, by and large, the Board of Control has obligations about everything that goes on in this, you know, on this campus, and interest in the welfare of the student body and in the physical and spiritual and mental welfare of its faculty, and it wants to provide. Especially, are we responsible to the church? And I don't just mean the next convention. We're responsible, and so are you. Not only faculty, but also you who are preparing for the ministry. You have responsibilities about which you may not have thought too strongly or at any length in meditation. You are the product of this seminary. The Board of Control is judged by what you do when you get out there into the ministry. The faculty is judged by what you do when you get out there in the ministry. And especially those to whom you minister, they will get their idea of who this outfit is and what its faculty is like and what kind of a school it is by how you minister to the needs of the people out there. To prepare a man for ministry, as you know, because you have been on the receiving end of it mostly, is quite a complicated thing. The parish pastor has got to be all things to all men. And the wider his range of knowledge, the better may he be able to understand what goes on in this little old world of ours. I just returned from South Dakota Monday morning. I was out there with the ranchers and the farmers. There are many towns in that country. Anyone from South Dakota here? I think somebody said 600,000 people in the whole state. Half of them live near Sioux Falls, and on the other end it's Rapid City. In between are the ranches, and they're getting bigger, which means less people per square mile, and so here they are, and I'm, you know, a real educated character. But I have to talk to these lay people. And happily, I have all my life worked among ordinary people. And I don't mean that demeaningly any which way, but people who don't make their living with their heads necessarily, but with their hands. And when you then talk to them, and you are going to be doing that, don't see how many big words you can get into this business. Doesn't work that way. I did some vicaring under a man who had always worked in rural situations too. And that first sermon that I submitted for his approval, man, I had her all down pat. And I gave him the sermon, and a couple of hours later he gave it back with all these circles. And I say, what are all those about? And he says, every one of those circled words, my people won't understand. Now, if you want to preach so that people can't understand you, that may be your idea. My idea is to say something that's going to be some good to them, and therefore take out these fool words. And you know, you sit and you're used to a certain vocabulary, and now you want to say that in the pulpit, and it sails right over the top of the whole, and you may just as well have stayed in bed. Maybe better. You may improve the vocabulary of your people a little, upgrade, but be careful. One big word to one sermon is enough. If you're going to communicate, do it in a language which they can understand. And I don't mean the four-letter words, which I hear every once in a while these days from the mouth of some pastors, not necessarily ours. You don't impress anybody with that, nor do you impress them with long words. And the business of the Board of Control seems to me to be also here, that we produce a group of people who will go out and in a dedicated manner apply themselves to whatever it is the parish needs to have in order that it might thrive individually and corporately. The size of the Board of Control varies with different schools. Here you have 11. And I think there are diversified enough gifts in this that there is no problem. We cover pretty well the waterfront, especially among the talents of our laymen. Well, gives you some idea of where to start, and now you are free to ask any question that might enter your mind on any subject that we have covered or didn't cover. Yes, sir.
Not necessarily giving a reason for the forced retirement or even dismissal of a man certainly has some sense, but giving the reason always to be given to the man himself privately.
But
as to if the general public opinion is one that is better than the real reason, if we can put a value judgment on that, then rather is good to keep the real reason disguised, as you gave or showed by your example. If, however, the public reason or the reason that everybody's thinking might be worse than the real reason, it might be wise to reveal the real reason.
The problem with that philosophy, sir, is that if you say it for one, you have to say it for all. When you say without cause and let people do what they want with that, there may be real fine sound reasons, or there may be reasons which you don't want to reveal. But if you say it in the case of one, then you come to the other case where it would do real injury to the man. And I think the old forefathers were kind of smart when they wrote it in there without cause. How, for instance, do you undertake to tell a professor who's now 65 and then he's 68 and then he's 72, tell him, Buster, you're just getting old. And that's a good reason. But who wants to admit, you know, that he isn't full of vim, vigor, and vitality, and now all this wisdom that he gleaned over the years, and now that should all be for naught? Better just leave it without cause all the way across the board, then no one can say that you have broken the Eighth Commandment by saying a man was a lush or a whatever. So you say nothing. Sir.
Yeah, you mentioned, I guess, in the same situation that we have to have faith and confidence. I myself find it easier to have faith and confidence in some people that I've been able to communicate with and thus understand. I feel sometimes a little frustration in that I have no idea of what policy is being discussed and decided upon until that policy has already been decided upon, and then the only communication I can make is one which has really very little effect. I was wondering if it's possible and proper to have some type of communication with the students, not that we would dictate, but that we would at least know what's going on and possibly be able to say, well, this is what we're thinking about, this is some of the reasons. Could we get a little input from you, you know, a little input from the students to kind of help us decide? Mm-hmm.
I hear what you're saying, and I think it would be great, except for the fact that, well, let me say, first of all, there are lines of communication between students and the board through the faculty and student body president and what have you, who from time to time come to talk, but mostly through faculty, and your president will then represent the feelings of the student body as it's communicated to him. The trouble is, these are busy men, and they come in here on a Sunday night, and they want to get home again on Monday because they've got court dates, they've got loans to worry about, and income tax, and whatever it is that the man is interested in. So that you can't have meetings that are very long because of the obligations these men have. But you can certainly communicate through the dean of students, the academic dean, whatever it happens to be, the president of the institution, through your own student body officials, and your counselors and advisors, and from time to time, I think that it would be good if you people would invite a member of the Board of Control. We've done that in times past, to visit in a dorm after the board meeting is over. Of course, nowadays, it seems our board meetings last until 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and by that time, no one wants to do much visiting anymore. But I recall a year or two ago, we had these things going, got a free bottle of beer and everything. And that was great. Now, as far as formal communication is concerned, I think if you address yourself to your people, and if you have something that you want to say in person, I don't recall that the Board of Control has ever turned anyone down who wanted to talk.
Or what you are deciding upon until it has been decided upon, and then those channels really aren't that effective because the decision has been reached already. I'm thinking especially of say, the library situation, where that came as a surprise to a lot of people. I'm not judging it right or wrong, but I am saying it came as a surprise, and the channels were open, but how could you communicate when we didn't know what was going on in your minds?
Mm-hmm. Now I see what you mean. However, you know, most of the Board of Control members don't have any advance notice either, except for maybe a week or so when the agenda for that particular meeting reaches them. I don't know how a person would go about seeking advice and counsel from the student body ahead of things. Most of them are not that terrifically important, I don't imagine, but I can see where a thing like the library would certainly be of interest to everybody concerned. I don't know what we can do about it. Dr. Klotz?
I just point this out, that the Board of Control has asked Dr. Bowman to to try to set up meetings with the students on an informal basis, and we've just not been able to work it out. We've been talking to that's not Randy a minute ago. We have been trying to work something out with Randy. So the Board of Control is aware of this and really anxious to sit down and meet with the students. Actually, the board meetings, the times that have been set, haven't suited with the students, and it's just not been possible to get together with them.
That's a good thought to keep in mind. Yes, sir.
As you were defining the makeup of the board, a couple of questions entered my mind, or maybe you can give me a better understanding. You know, I have an appreciation for the role of the laymen in our church, but as you pointed out yourself, that when it comes to financial affairs, sometimes clergymen or pastors are pretty stupid. And I think maybe sometimes the reverse of that can be true in matters of confessions or theology. Businessman thinks in millions of dollars, so to speak. You know, how practical is he in the areas of doctrine and theology? And so I wonder about the makeup of the board and also the makeup of its concern to think the collage of background and a collage of responsibilities within a relatively small group of people. Consisting of seven laymen, as I understand. So in matters of doctrine and theology, I'm just wondering about the sensitivity there.
Well, I think the makeup of the thing is such that there are those who have expertise in the business affairs and others who have expertise in matters of academics and, for that matter, also doctrine. Although I would caution all of you, the laymen are not entirely bereft of theological knowledge. And our lay people on the Board of Control, I think, have had a pretty fine education in the fine points of theological thought. They interviewed, they looked at transcripts, they looked up Bible passages, they heard the argumentation, they were there for the discussions back and forth between the preachers and the professors who were interviewed, and they read, and they get the materials from the CTCR. You will find among these people some real fine, theologically oriented people. I always like to think of when I first came into my own parish. I served as an assistant for 2 years, which were not the happiest of my life, in southern Illinois. And then I went to northern Michigan near the Straits of Mackinac, and I got there on a Wednesday morning. And Wednesday evening came three people. They had a card table and three chairs, a basket of sandwiches, and a case of beer. And the patriarch was a fellow with a beard down to about here. And I invited him in, although the house didn't look exactly presentable. I hadn't done any cleaning, certainly. So what can I do for you, gentlemen? Well, we came over to talk things over with you, says this bearded gent, who was about 80 years old at the time. It is our function in the kingdom of God to train young pastors, he announces. We know we have a small parish here. We know you're not going to be around very long. But if you will allow it, we will train you for bigger things. And then we got to talking about theology, and that old fella knew some theology that I hadn't yet caught up with, really, in his practical application to things that happened in his life. Now, I think the balance in the Board of Control is deliberately set about between lay and clergy and teachers, so that there is a good mix, and everybody then can get to use whatever expertise they have for the problem. Sir?
As far as the
retirement or dismissal of a certain professor or whatever, how would the Board of Control go about arriving at whatever opinion they might have? Would they interview a professor, sitting on his classes, a recommendation of the president or some other faculty member? What exactly would be the process?
Well, I assume that you'd get a lot of it from the president of the institution, the head of the department in which the man operates, probably the academic dean and the dean of students, who all listen to what you people have to say about your professors. And then the observation which the Board of Control people make of professors as they see them, and if a man is running around on one gimpy leg with a cane and he's now 65 years old and doesn't seem to, you know, be able to operate anymore, well, that's one thing. In our case, in the retirements that were made by this Board of Control, much of it was a matter of plain, ordinary finances. If you have a budget and you see your income and your disbursements and there is a gap of $125,000, what do you do next? So you take those departments which seem overstaffed, because we have to reduce faculty. And these were eligible for retirement, and that retirement isn't all bad. It isn't. It sounds as though these people were going to starve to death the first thing in the morning, but it isn't always so. They have been living a pretty good life, or salary-wise at least, and they ought to have a saving or two, and then their pension funds are in good repair, and it isn't so bad. You see, when you start talking about tenure, what's my tenure? Or Dr. Preuss's? Or President Ford? Every 4 years, somebody decides to cut off the tenure, huh? If that's how they feel. And I have got to come for an evaluation every 4 years. Luckily, I could stay in the same congregation for 29 years, but I'm sure that every Sunday morning, I was up for review, too. And once a year, they talked about salaries and these things. It isn't only a matter of professors. This is part of living in this little old world of ours. And nowadays, and I think you people are going to have the problems with it, there comes developing a spirit of anti-clericalism. Because of this business of the autonomy of the congregation being dragged out to cover the ordaining of Seminex graduates. The laymen do a little thinking too, and they say, if the rubrics of the synod, the bylaws, can be broken in favor of ordaining a Seminex grad, then I guess we can get rid of that preacher whom we didn't like for the last 5 years. And they are doing it. It's wrong. But it's done in reaction to what has been said and what has been done. The congregation is autonomous, to be sure, but when we decide to do things together, we give up part of our autonomy. And then we subscribe to certain bylaws together for the good of the whole. And among these is, how do people get into our ministry? And if they don't come in this way, then they're illegitimate somehow. Not because they may lack in knowledge or academics or whatever, but they didn't come in as we had proposed that we want to bring them in, and therefore, they are not certified. And if now you come and say the autonomy says you can get anybody, that's true. A congregation can call a Buddhist to be their pastor if that's what they want to do, but not in the Missouri Synod. because here we have agreed together to do it another way. Well, a lot of words. I don't want to take up. Yes.
And this library thing's been in our temp spot, and then after Pastor Otto's speech recently, it came up again. I was wondering, did he give a correct explanation of the library policy, or was he rather trapped in a situation there where he was put in a position where he needed hasty words? He said in this statement that they could, some next people could use the library, but they couldn't check books out. And we'd all interpreted it to say that they couldn't even walk, you know, they couldn't use it. Go as far as the circulation desk, and then they were asked not to go further.
As I understand the policy, they are not to use the library. And I don't think that that is so difficult to understand. Do you know what you're paying for the library?
I accept that. I was just wondering if he had understood this correctly, or if he had expressed it correctly when he talked to this man, because it seems a revision, what he said seems a revision of the library policy that we had that handed down to us.
I didn't hear his speech, and I haven't read it either. But I understood the policy to be that Seminex is not to use it as a student body. Now, individually, preachers can come, everybody in Synod can come, but they don't come 350 strong or 400 or whatever there is. And one institution has a library, the other one is expected to have one too. Now, if we're going to reciprocate, then, if there is no library in one place and the whole thing is on the other, you see that. But I understood that to mean that they are not to use it.
That's what I thought too.
Of course, I don't think they've thrown anybody out either. Sir?
I'm just going to say for this sake that the doctor, Reverend Otto, is going to have an explanation of his remarks of the very last spectrum, the next spectrum. He does understand what, and he knows what the policy is, and he'll explain how we.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how he got in that situation. But anyway, an explanation will be given.
Good. Anyone else? Well, it's the hour is gone, but I enjoyed being here. Thank you for letting me in. Anytime you want to visit and I'm around, happy. Sir.
I just wonder, when are we getting our new president? I mean, as when Doug Goldman...
Where are we with that? Does any... I don't really know. Well, the 90 days are over, are they not, since we asked for candidates?
The list will close the end of February, and then I guess there's about 6 weeks that must elapse, so that probably the earliest would be something like the first week in May.
When the election can take place.
Yes, the election could not be earlier than about the first week in May. One of the problems is the deadlines for the witness. It is not only 6 weeks, but it's 6 weeks after the deadline for the witness. And we lose a little time there.
Yeah. But evidently you're going to have to get along with an acting president for this academic year. And I think you've got a considerable acting president. Yeah, great man.
Dr. Weber, we certainly appreciate your being here today. I wish I could invite you to lunch, but I have a luncheon meeting. There may be somebody here who would...
I have a luncheon meeting,
do you?
Yes. I was going to say that we'd call for a volunteer and I'd give you a ticket.
No, I'm...
Thank you very much.